And Yancey Harrington. I think he'll emote his fucking heart out. His big deathbed scene. He'll be so good he'll make Betty Davis and Dark Victory look like Ally McGraw in Love Story.
Oh, but it's not like that at all, Roger began.
Rob shrugged. Yeah, maybe that's a little unfair. Okay, call it his, curtain call, then. Whatever you want to call it, I've been in this business long enough to believe that there wouldn't be a dry eye in the house after that commercial was shown over a 3 or 4 week period. It would knock everybody on their asses. But the beers came. The waiter said to Rob, Mr. Johnson asked me to tell you that he has several parties of three waiting, Mr. Martin. Well, you run back and tell Mr. Johnson that the boys are on their last round and to keep his undies dry, okay, Rocky?
The waiter smiled, emptied the ashtray, and nodded. He left. Rob turned back to Vic and Roger.
So, what's the bottom line? You're bright boys. You don't need a one-legged cameraman with a snoot full of beer to tell you where the bear shat in the buckwheat.
Sharp just won't apologize, Vic said. That's what you think, isn't it?
Rob saluted him with his bottle of beer.
Go to the head of the class. It's not an apology, Roger said plaintively. It's a fucking explanation.
You see it that way, Rob answered. But will he?
Ask yourself that. I met that old geezer a couple of times. He'd see it in terms of the captain deserting the sinking ship ahead of the women and children, giving up the Alamo, every stereotype you can think of. No, I'll tell you what I think is going to happen, my friends.
He raised his glass and drank slowly.
I think a valuable and all too short relationship is going to come to an end very soon now. Old man Sharp is going to listen to your proposal. He's going to shake his head. He's going to usher you out. Permanently. And the next PR firm will be chosen by his son, who will make his pick based on which one he believes will give him the freest rein to indulge his crackpot ideas.
Maybe, Roger said. But maybe he'll...
Maybe doesn't matter shit one way or the other, Vic said vehemently. The only difference between a good advertising man and a good snake oil salesman is that a good advertising man does the best job he can with the materials at hand, without stepping outside the bounds of honesty. That's what this commercial is about. If he turns it down, he's turning down the best we can do, and that's the end. Toot Finney.
He snuffed his cigarette and almost knocked over Roger's half-full bottle of beer. His hands were shaking. Rob nodded.
I'll drink to that, he raised his glass. A toast, gentlemen.
Vic and Roger raised their own glasses. Rob thought for a moment and then said,
May things turn out all right, even against the odds.
Amen, Roger said.
They clinked their glasses together and drank. As he downed the rest of his beer, Vic found himself thinking about Donna and Tad again.
George Mira, the mailman, lifted one leg clad in blue-gray post office issue and farted. Just lately, he farted a great deal. He was mildly worried about it. It didn't seem to matter what he had been eating. Last night he and his wife had had creamed cod on toast, and he had farted. This morning Kellogg's Product 19 with a banana cut up in it, and he had farted. This noon, down at the Mellow Tiger in town, two cheeseburgers with mayonnaise. Ditto farts.
He had looked up the symptom in the Home Medical Encyclopedia, an invaluable tome in 12 volumes which his wife had gotten a volume at a time by saving her checkout slips from the Shop and Save in South Paris. What George Mira had discovered under the excessive flatulence heading had not been particularly encouraging.
It could be a symptom of gastric upset. It could mean he had a nice little ulcer incubating in there. It could be a bowel problem. It could even mean the big C. If it kept up, he supposed he would go see old Dr. Quentin. Dr. Quentin would tell him he was farting a lot because he was getting older, and that was it. Aunt Evie Chalmers' death that last spring had hit George hard, harder than he ever would have believed, and just lately he didn't like to think about getting older. He preferred to think about the golden years of retirement, years that he and Kathy would spend together. No more getting up at 6:30, no more heaving around sacks of mail and listening to that asshole Michael Fournier who was the Castle Rock postmaster. No more freezing his balls off in the winter and going crazy with all the summer people who wanted delivery to their camps and cottages when the warm weather came. Instead, there would be a Winnebago for scenic trips through New England. There would be puttering in the garden. There would be all sorts of new hobbies. Most of all, there would be rest and relaxation. And somehow, the thought of farting his way through his late 60s and early 70s like a defective rocket just didn't jibe with his fond picture of the golden years of retirement. He turned at the small blue-and-white mail truck onto Town Road Number 3, wincing as the glare of sunlight shifted briefly across the windshield. The summer had turned out every bit as hot as Aunt Evie had prophesied. All of that and then some. He could hear crickets singing sleepily in the high summer grass and had a brief vision out of the golden years of retirement, a scene entitled George Relaxes in the Backyard Hammock. He stopped at the Millikens and pushed a Zayers advertising circular and a CMP power bill into the box. This was the day all the power bills went out, but he hoped the CMP folks wouldn't hold their breath until the Millikens' check came in. The Millikens were poor white trash, like that Gary Pervier just up the road. It was nothing but a scandal to see what was happening to Pervier, a man who had once won a DSC. And old Joe Camber wasn't a hell of a lot better. They were going to the dogs, the both of them. John Milliken was out in the side yard repairing what looked like a harrow. George gave him a wave, and Milliken flicked one finger curtly in return before going back to his work. "Here's one for you, you old welfare chiseler," George Mira thought. He lifted his leg and blew his trombone. It was a hell of a thing, this farting. You had to be pretty damn careful when you were out in company. He drove on up the road to Gary Pervier's, produced another Zayers circular, another power bill, and added a VFW newsletter. He tucked them into the box and then turned around in Gary's driveway, because he didn't have to drive all the way up to Camber's place today. Joe had called the post office yesterday morning around 10 and had asked them to hold his mail for a few days. Mike Fournier, the big talker who was in charge of things at the Castle Rock P.O., had routinely filled out a hold mail until notified card and flipped it over to George's station. Fournier told Joe Camber he had called just about 15 minutes too late to stop the Monday delivery of mail, if that had been his intention. "Don't matter," Joe had said. "I guess I'll be around to get today's." When George put Gary Pervier's mail into his box, he noticed that Gary's Monday delivery, a popular mechanics and a charity begging letter from the Rural Scholarship Fund, had not been removed. Now, turning around, he noticed that Gary's big old Chrysler was in the dooryard, and Joe Camber's rusting around the edges station wagon was parked right behind it. "Gone off together," he muttered aloud. "Two fools off hooting somewhere." He lifted his leg and farted again. George's conclusion was that the two of them were probably off drinking and whoring, wheeling around in Joe Camber's pickup truck. It didn't occur to him to wonder why they would have taken Joe's truck when there were two much more comfortable vehicles near at hand. And he didn't notice the blood on the porch steps, or the fact that there was a large hole in the lower panel of Gary's screen door. "Two fools off hooting," he repeated. "At least Joe Camber remembered to cancel his mail." He drove off the way he had come, back toward Castle Rock, lifting his leg every now and then to blow his trombone. Steve Kemp drove out to the Dairy Queen by the Westbrook Shopping Mall for a couple of cheeseburgers and a dilly bar. He sat in his van, eating and looking out at Brighton Avenue, not really seeing the road or tasting the food. He had called Handsome Hubby's office. He gave his name as Adam Swallow when the secretary asked, said he was the marketing director for House of Lights Incorporated and would like to talk to Mr. Trenton. He had been dry-mouthed with excitement. And when Trenton got on the old hooter, they could find more interesting things than marketing to talk about. Like the little woman's birthmark and what it might look like. Like how she had bitten him once when she came, hard enough to draw blood. Like how things were going for the bitch goddess since Handsome Hubby discovered she had a little taste for what was on the other side of the sheets. But things hadn't turned out that way. The secretary had said, "I'm sorry, but both Mr. Trenton and Mr. Breakstone are out of the office this week. They'll probably be out most of next week as well. If I could help you." Her voice had a rising, hopeful inflection. She really did want to help. It was her big chance to land an account while the bosses were taking care of business in Boston or maybe New York. Surely no place as exotic as L.A., not a little dipshit agency like AdWorks. So get out there and tap dance until your shoes smoke, kid. He thanked her and told her he would ring back toward the end of the month. He hung up before she could ask for his number, since the office of the House of Lights Incorporated was in a Congress Street phone booth across from Joe's smoke shop. Now here he was, eating cheeseburgers and wondering what to do next. "As if you didn't know," an interior voice whispered. He started the van up and headed for Castle Rock. By the time he finished his lunch, the dilly bar was practically running down the stick in the heat. He was in North Windham. He threw his trash on the floor of the van, where it joined a drift of like stuff, plastic drink containers, Big Mac boxes, returnable beer and soda bottles, empty cigarette packs. Littering was an antisocial, anti-environmentalist act, and he didn't do it. Steve got to the Trenton house at just 3:30 on that hot, glaring afternoon. Acting with almost subliminal caution, he drove past the house without slowing and parked around the corner on a side street, about 1/4 mile away. He walked back. The driveway was empty, and he felt a pang of frustrated disappointment. He would not admit to himself, especially now that it looked like she was out, that he had intended to give her a taste of what she had been so eager to have during the spring. Nevertheless, he had driven all the way from Westbrook to Castle Rock with a semi-erection that only now collapsed completely. She was gone. No, the car was gone. One thing didn't necessarily prove the other, did it? Steve looked around himself. "What we have here, ladies and gents, is a peaceful suburban street on a summer's day. Most of the kiddies in for naps, most of the little wifeys either doing likewise or glued to their TVs, checking out Love of Life or Search for Tomorrow. All the handsome hubbies are busy earning their way into higher tax brackets, and very possibly a bed in the intensive care ward at the Eastern Maine Medical Center." Two little kids were playing hopscotch on a blurred chalk grid. They were wearing bathing suits and sweating heavily. An old balding lady was trundling a wire shopping caddy back from town, as if both she and it were made of the finest bone china. She gave the kids playing hopscotch a wide berth. In short, not much happening. The street was dozing in the heat. Steve walked up the sloping driveway as if he had every right to be there. First, he looked in the tiny one-car garage. He had never known Donna to use it, and she had told him once she was afraid to drive her car into it because the doorway was so narrow. If she put a dent in her car, Handsome Hubby would give her hell. No, excuse me, he would give her heck. The garage was empty. No Pinto, No elderly jag. Donna's handsome hubby was into what was known as sports car menopause. She hadn't liked him saying that, but Steve had never seen a more obvious case. Steve left the garage and went up the three steps to the back stoop, tried the door, found it unlocked. He went inside without knocking after another casual glance around to make sure no one was in sight. He closed the door on the silence of the house. Once more, his heart was knocking heavily in his chest, seeming to shake his whole ribcage. And once again, he was not admitting things. He didn't have to admit them. They were there just the same.
"Hi? Anybody home?"
His voice was loud, honest, pleasant, inquiring.
"Hi?"
He was halfway down the hall now. Obviously, no one home. The house had a silent, hot, waiting feeling. An empty house full of furniture was somehow creepy when it wasn't your house. You felt watched.
"Hello? Anybody home?"
One last time.
"Give her something to remember you by, then. And split."
He went into the living room and stood looking around. His shirt sleeves were rolled up, his forearms lightly slicked with sweat. Now things could be admitted. How he had wanted to kill her when she called him a son of a bitch, her spittle spraying on his face. How he had wanted to kill her for making him feel old and scared and not able to keep on top of the situation anymore. The letter had been something, but the letter hadn't been enough. To his right, knick-knacks stood on a series of glass shelves. He turned and gave the bottom shelf a sudden hard kick. It disintegrated. The frame tottered and then fell over, spraying glass, spraying little china figurines of cats and shepherds and all that happy bourgeois horseshit. A pulse throbbed in the center of his forehead. He was grimacing, unaware of the fact. He walked carefully over the unbroken figurines, crushing them into powder. He pulled a family portrait from the wall, looked curiously at the smiling face of Vic Trenton for a moment. Tad was sitting on his lap and his arm was around Donna's waist. And then he dropped the picture to the floor and stamped down hard on the glass. He looked around, breathing hard, as if he had just run a race. And suddenly he went after the room as if it were something alive, something that had hurt him badly and needed to be punished, as if it were the room that had caused his pain. He pushed over Vic's Lazy Boy recliner. He upended the couch. It stood on end for a moment, rocking uneasily, and then went down with a crash, breaking the back of the coffee table which had stood in front of it. He pulled all the books out of the bookcases, cursing the shitty taste of the people who had bought them under his breath as he did it. He picked up the magazine stand and threw it overhand at the mirror over the mantelpiece, shattering it. Big pieces of black-backed mirror fell onto the floor like chunks of a jigsaw puzzle. He was snorting now like a bull in heat. His thin cheeks were almost purple with color. He went into the kitchen by way of the small dining room. As he walked past the dining room table Donna's parents had bought them as a housewarming present, he extended his arm straight out and swept everything off onto the floor. The Lazy Susan with its compliments of spices, the cut glass vase Donna had gotten for $1.25 at the Emporium Galorium in Bridgeton the summer previous, Vic's graduation beer stein, the ceramic salt and pepper shakers shattered like bombs. His erection was back now, raging. Thoughts of caution, of possible discovery, had departed his mind. He was somewhere inside. He was down a dark hole. In the kitchen, he yanked the bottom drawer of the stove out to its stop and threw pots and pans everywhere. They made a dreadful clatter, but there was no satisfaction in mere clatter. A rank of cupboards ran around three of the room's four sides. He pulled them open, one after the other. He grabbed plates by the double handful and threw them on the floor. Crockery jingled musically. He swept the glasses out and grunted as they broke. Among them was a set of 8 delicate long-stemmed wine glasses that Donna had had since she was 12 years old. She had read about hope chests in some magazine or other and had determined to have such a chest of her own. As it turned out, the wine glasses were the only thing she had actually put in hers before losing interest. Her original grand intention had been to lay by enough to completely furnish her bridal house or flat. But she had had them for more than half her life, and they were treasured. The gravy boat went, the big serving platter. The Sears radio tape player went on the floor with a heavy crunch. Steve Kemp danced on it. He boogied on it. His penis, hard as a stone, throbbed inside his pants. The vein in the center of his forehead throbbed in counterpoint. He discovered booze under the small chromium sink in the corner. He yanked out 1/2 and 3/4 full bottles by the armload and then flung them at the closed door of the kitchen closet one by one, throwing them overhand as hard as he could. The next day his right arm would be so stiff and sore he would barely be able to lift it to shoulder level. Soon the blue closet door was running with Gilby's gin, Jack Daniels, J&B whiskey, sticky green creme de menthe, the amaretto that had been a Christmas present from Roger and Althea Breakstone. Glass twinkled benignly in the hot afternoon sunlight pouring through the windows over the sink. Steve tore into the laundry room, where he found boxes of bleach, spick and span, downy fabric softener in a large blue plastic bottle, Less Toil, Top Job, and 3 kinds of powdered detergent. He ran back and forth through the kitchen like a lunatic New Year's Eve celebrant, pouring these cleaning potions everywhere. He had just emptied the last carton, an economy-sized box of Tide that had been almost full, when he saw the message scrawled on the note-minder in Donna's unmistakable spiky handwriting. Tad and I have gone out to J. Camber's garage with Pinto. Back soon. That brought him back to the realities of the situation with the bang. He had already been here 1/2 hour at least, maybe longer. The time had passed in a red blur, and it was hard to peg it any more closely than that. How long had she been gone when he came in? Who had the note been left for? Anybody who might pop in, or someone specific? He had to get out of here. But there was one other thing he had to do first. He erased the message on the note-minder with one swipe of his sleeve and wrote in large block letters, "I left something upstairs for you, baby." He took the stairs 2 by 2 and came into their bedroom, which was to the left of the 2nd-floor landing. He felt terribly pressed now, almost positive that the doorbell was going to ring, or someone, another happy housewife most likely, would poke her head in the back door and call as he had, "Hi, anybody home?" But perversely, that added the final spice of excitement to this happening. He unbuckled his belt, jerked his fly down, and let his jeans drop down around his knees. He wasn't wearing underpants. He rarely did. His cock stood out stiffly from a mass of reddish-gold pubic hair. It didn't take long. He was too excited. 2 or 3 quick jerks through his closed fist, and orgasm came, immediate and savage. He spat semen onto the bedspread in a convulsion. He yanked his jeans back up, raked the zipper closed, almost catching the head of his penis in the zipper's small gold teeth. That would have been a laugh, all right, and ran for the door, buckling his belt again. He would meet someone as he was going out. Yes, he felt positive of it, as if it were preordained. Some happy housewife who would take one look at his flushed face, his bulging eyes, his tented jeans, and scream her head off. He tried to prepare himself for it as he opened the back door and went out. In retrospect, it seemed that he had made enough noise to wake the dead. Those pans! Why had he thrown those fucking pans around? What had he been thinking of? Everyone in the neighborhood must have heard. But there was no one in the yard or in the driveway. The peace of the afternoon was undisturbed. Across the street a lawn sprinkler twirled unconcernedly. A kid went by on roller skates.
Straight ahead was a high hedge which separated the Trentons' house lot from the next one over. Looking to the left from the back stoop was a view of the town nestled at the bottom of the hill. Steve could see the intersection of Route 117 and High Street quite clearly, the town common nestled in one of the angles made by the crossing of the two roads. He stood there on the stoop, trying to get his shit back together. His breath slowed a little at a time back into a more normal inhale-exhale pattern. He found a pleasant afternoon face and put it on. All this happened in the length of time it took for the traffic light on the corner to cycle from red to amber to green and back to red again.
What if she pulls into the driveway right now?
That got him going again. He'd left his calling card. He didn't need any hassle from her on top of it. There was no way she could do a thing anyway, unless she called the cops. And he didn't think she'd do that. There were too many things he could tell. The sex life of the great American happy housewife in its natural habitat. It had been a crazy scene, though. Best to put miles between himself and Castle Rock. Maybe later he would give her a call, ask her how she had liked his work. That might be sort of fun. He walked down the driveway, turned left, and went back to his van. He wasn't stopped. Nobody took any undue notice of him. A kid on roller skates zipped past him and shouted, "Hi!" Steve hied him right back. He got in the van and started it up. He drove up 117 to 302 and followed that road to its intersection with Interstate 95 in Portland. He took an interstate time and toll ticket and rolled south. He had begun having uneasy thoughts about what he had done, the red rage of destruction he had gone into when he saw that no one was home. Had the retribution been too heavy for the offense? So she didn't want to make it with him anymore. So what? He had trashed most of the goddamn house. Did that maybe say something unpleasant about where his head was at? He began to work on these questions a little at a time, the way most people do, running an objective set of facts through a bath of various chemicals, which, when taken together, make up the complex human perceptual mechanism known as subjectivity. Like a schoolchild who works carefully first with the pencil, then with the eraser, then with the pencil again, he tore down what had happened, and then carefully rebuilt it, redrew it in his mind, until both the facts and his perception of the facts jibed in a way he could live with. When he reached Route 495, he turned west toward New York and the country that sprawled beyond, all the way to the silent reaches of Idaho, the place that Papa Hemingway had gone to when he was old and mortally hurt. He felt the familiar lift in his feelings that came with cutting old ties and moving on, that magical thing that Huck had called lighting out for the territory. At such times he felt almost newborn, felt strongly that he was in possession of the greatest freedom of all, the freedom to recreate himself. He would have been unable to understand the significance if someone had pointed out the fact that, whether in Maine or in Idaho, he would still be apt to throw his racket down in angry frustration if he lost a game of tennis, that he would refuse to shake the hand of his opponent over the net, as he always had when he lost. He only shook over the net when he won. He stopped for the night in a small town called Twickenham. His sleep was easy. He had convinced himself that trashing the Trentons' house had not been an act of half-mad jealous pique, but a piece of revolutionary anarchy. Offing a couple of fat middle-class pigs, the sort who made it easy for the fascist overlords to remain in power by blindly paying their taxes and their telephone bills. It had been an act of courage and of clean, justified fury. It was his way of saying power to the people, an idea he tried to incorporate in all his poems. Still, he mused as he turned toward sleep in the narrow motel bed,
He wondered what Donna had thought of it when she and the kid got home. That sent him to sleep with a slight smile on his lips. By 3:30 that Tuesday afternoon, Donna had given up on the mailman. She sat with one arm lightly around Tad, who was in a dazed half-sleep, his lips cruelly puffed from the heat, his face hectic and flushed. There was a tiny bit of the milk left, and soon she would give it to him. During the last 3.5 hours, since what would have been lunchtime at home, the sun had been monstrous and unremitting. Even with her window and Tad's window open a quarter of the way, the temperature inside must have reached 100 degrees, maybe more. It was the way your car got when you left it in the sun, that was all. Except, under normal circumstances, what you did when your car got like that was you unrolled all the windows, pulled the knobs that opened the air ducts, and got rolling. Let's get rolling. What a sweet sound those words had. She licked her lips. For short periods, she had unrolled the windows all the way, creating a mild draft, but she was afraid to leave them that way. She might doze off. The heat scared her. It scared her for herself and even more for Tad, what it might be taking out of him. But it didn't scare her as badly as the face of the dog, slavering foam and staring at her with its sullen red eyes. The last time she had unrolled the windows all the way was when Cujo had disappeared into the shadows of the barn garage. But now Cujo was back. He sat in the lengthening shadow of the big barn, his head lowered, staring at the blue Pinto. The ground between his front paws was muddy from his slaver. Every now and then he would growl and snap at empty air as if he might be hallucinating. How long? How long before he dies? She was a rational woman. She did not believe in monsters from closets. She believed in things she could see and touch. There was nothing supernatural about the slobbering wreck of a St. Bernard sitting in the shade of a barn. He was merely a sick animal that had been bitten by a rabid fox or skunk or something. He wasn't out to get her personally. He wasn't the Reverend Dimmesdale or Moby Dog. He was not four-footed fate. But she had just about decided to make a run for the back door of the enclosed camber porch when Cujo had come rolling and staggering out of the darkness inside the barn. Tad. Tad was the thing. She had to get him out of this. No more fucking around. He wasn't answering very coherently anymore. He seemed to be in touch only with the peaks of reality. The glazed way his eyes rolled toward her when she spoke to him, like the eyes of a fighter who has been struck and struck and struck, a fighter who has lost his coherence along with his mouth guard and is waiting only for the final flurry of punches to drop him insensible to the canvas. Those things terrified her and roused all her motherhood. Tad was the thing. If she had been alone, she would have gone for that door long ago. It was Tad who had held her back, because her mind kept circling back to the thought of the dog pulling her down, and of Tad in the car alone. Still, until Cujo had returned 15 minutes ago, she had been preparing herself to go for the door. She played it over and over in her mind like a home movie, did it until it seemed to one part of her mind as if it had already happened. She would shake Tad fully awake, slap him awake if she had to, tell him he was not to leave the car and follow her, under no circumstances, no matter what happens. She would run from the car to the porch door, try the knob. If it was unlocked, well and fine. But she was prepared for the very real possibility that it was locked. She had taken off her shirt and now sat behind the wheel in her white cotton bra, the shirt in her lap. When she went, she would go with the shirt wrapped around her hand. Far from perfect protection, but better than none at all. She would smash in the pane of the glass nearest the doorknob, reach through, and let herself onto the little back porch. And if the inner door was locked, she would cope with that, too. Somehow. But Cujo had come back out, and that took away her edge.
Never mind. He'll go back in. He has before.
But will he? Her mind chattered. It's all too perfect, isn't it? The Cambers are gone, and they remember to shut off their mail like good citizens. Vic is gone, and the chances are slim that he'll call before tomorrow night, because we just can't afford long distance every night. And if he does call, he'll call early. When he doesn't get any answer, he'll assume we went out to catch some chow at Mario's, or maybe a couple of ice creams at the Tasty Freeze. And he won't call later because he'll think we're asleep. He'll call tomorrow instead. Consider it, Vic. Yes, it's all just too perfect. Wasn't there a dog in the front of the boat in that story about the boatman on the river, Karen? The boatman's dog? Just call me Cujo. All out for the Valley of Death.
Go in, she silently willed the dog. Go back in the barn, damn you.
Cujo didn't move. She licked her lips, which felt almost as puffy as Tad's looked. She brushed his hair off his forehead and said softly, "How you going, Tadder?"
"Shh," Tad muttered distractedly. "The ducks."
She gave him a shake. "Tad, honey, you okay? Talk to me." His eyes opened a little at a time. He looked around, a small boy who was puzzled and hot and dreadfully tired.
"Mommy, can't we go home? I'm so hot."
"We'll go home," she soothed.
"When, Mom? When?"
He began to cry helplessly.
"Oh, Tad, save your moisture," she thought. "You may need it."
Crazy thing to have to be thinking. But the entire situation was ridiculous to the point of lunacy, wasn't it? The idea of a small boy dying of dehydration? Stop it. He is not dying. Less than 7 miles from the nearest good-sized town was crazy.
"But the situation is what it is," she reminded herself roughly. "And don't you think anything else, sister. It's like a war on a miniaturized scale, so everything that looked small before looks big now. The smallest puff of air through the quarter-open windows was a zephyr. The distance to the back porch was 0.5 mile across no man's land. And if you want to believe the dog is fate, or the ghost of sins remembered, or even the reincarnation of Elvis Presley, then believe it. In this curiously scaled-down situation, this life-or-death situation, even having to go to the bathroom became a skirmish. We're going to get out of it. No dog is going to do this to my son."
"When, Mommy?"
He looked up to her, his eyes wet, his face as pale as cheese.
"Soon," she said grimly. "Very soon."
She brushed his hair back and held him against her. She looked out Tad's window, and again her eyes fixed on that thing lying in the high grass, that old friction-taped baseball bat.
"I'd like to bash your head in with it."
Inside the house, the phone began to ring. She jerked her head around, suddenly wild with hope.
"Is it for us, Mommy? Is the phone for us?"
She didn't answer him. She didn't know who it was for, but if they were lucky, and their luck was due to change soon, wasn't it? It would be from someone with cause to be suspicious that no one was answering the phone at the Cambers. Someone who would come out and check around. Cujo's head had come up, his head cocked to one side. And for a moment he bore an insane resemblance to Nipper, the RCA dog with his ear to the gramophone horn. He got shakily to his feet and started toward the house and the sound of the ringing telephone.
"Maybe the doggie's going to answer the telephone," Tad said.
maybe.
With a speed and agility that was terrifying, the big dog changed direction and came at the car. The awkward stagger was gone now, as if it had been nothing but a sly act all along. It was roaring and bellowing rather than barking. Its red eyes burned. It struck the car with a hard, dull crunch and rebounded. With stunned eyes, Donna saw that the side of her door was actually bowed in a bit. "It must be dead," she thought hysterically. "Bashed its sick brains in spinal fusion, deep concussion. Must have, must have, must have." Cujo got back up. His muzzle was bloody. His eyes seemed wandering, vacuous again. Inside the house, the phone rang on and on. The dog made as if to walk away, suddenly snapped viciously at its own flank as if stung, whirled, and sprang at Donna's window. It struck right in front of Donna's face with another tremendous dull thud. Blood sprayed across the glass and a long silver crack appeared. Tad shrieked and clapped his hands to his face, pulling his cheeks down, harrowing them with his fingernails. The dog leaped again. Ropes of foam runnered back from his bleeding muzzle. She could see his teeth, heavy as old yellow ivory. His claws clicked on the glass. A cut between his eyes was streaming blood. His eyes were fixed on hers, dumb, dull eyes. But not without, she would have sworn it, not without some knowledge, some malign knowledge. "Get out of here!" she screamed at it. Cujo threw himself against the side of the car below her window again, and again, and again. Now her door was badly dented inward. Each time the dog's 200-pound bulk struck the pinto, it rocked on its springs. Each time she heard that heavy, toneless thud, she felt sure it must have killed itself, at least knocked itself unconscious. And each time it trotted back toward the house, whirled, and charged the car again. Cujo's face was a mask of blood and matted fur from which his eyes, once a kind, mild brown, peered with stupid fury. She looked at Tad and saw that he had gone into a shock reaction, curling himself up into a tight fetal ball in his bucket seat, his hands laced together at the nape of his neck, his chest hitching. "Maybe that's best. Maybe..." Inside the house, the phone stopped ringing. Cujo, in the act of whirling around for another charge, paused. He cocked his head again in that curious, evocative gesture. Donna held her breath. The silence seemed very big. Cujo sat down, raised his horribly mangled nose toward the sky, and howled once. Such a dark and lonesome sound that she shivered, no longer hot, but as cold as a crypt. In that instant she knew, she did not feel or just think, she knew that the dog was something more than just a dog. The moment passed. Cujo got to his feet very slowly and wearily and walked around to the front of the pinto. She supposed he had lain down there. She could no longer see his tail. Nevertheless, she held herself tensed for a few moments longer, mentally ready in case the dog should spring up onto the hood as it had done before. It didn't. There was nothing but silence. She gathered Tad into her arms and began to croon to him. When Brett had at last given up and come out of the telephone booth, Charity took his hand and led him into Calder's coffee shop. They had come to Calder's to look at matching tablecloths and curtains. Holly was waiting for them, sipping the last of an ice cream soda. "Nothing wrong, is there?" she asked. "Nothing too serious," Charity said and ruffled his hair. "He's worried about his dog, aren't you, Brett?" Brett shrugged, then nodded miserably. "You go on ahead if you want," Charity said to her. "We'll catch up." "All right, I'll be downstairs." Holly finished her soda and said,
I bet your pooch is just fine, Brett.
Brett smiled at her as best he could, but didn't reply. They watched Holly walk away, smart in her dark burgundy dress and cork-soled sandals, smart in a way Charity knew she would never be able to duplicate. Maybe once, but not now. Holly had left her two with a sitter, and they had come into Bridgeport around noon. Holly had bought them a nice lunch, paying with a Diners Club card, and since then they had been shopping. But Brett had been quiet and withdrawn, worrying about Cujo. Charity didn't feel much like shopping herself. It was hot, and she was still a little unnerved by Brett's sleepwalking that morning. Finally, she had suggested that he try calling home from one of the booths around the corner from the snack bar, but the results had been precisely those of which she had been afraid. The waitress came. Charity ordered coffee, milk, and two Danish pastries. "Brett," she said, "when I told your father I wanted us to go on this trip, he was against it."
"Yeah, I figured that."
And then he changed his mind. He changed it all at once. I think that maybe he saw it as a chance for a little vacation of his own. Sometimes men like to go off by themselves, you know, and do things.
Like hunting?
And whoring and drinking, and God alone knows what else or why. Yes, like that.
And movies, Brett said.
Their snacks came, and he began munching his Danish. Yes, the X-rated kind on Washington Street. They call it the combat zone.
Could be.
Anyway, your father might have taken a couple of days to go to Boston.
Oh, I don't think so, Brett said earnestly. He had a lot of work, a lot of work. He told me so.
There might not have been as much as he thought, she said, hoping that the cynicism she felt hadn't rubbed through into her voice. Anyway, that's what I think he did, and that's why he didn't answer the phone yesterday or today. Drink your milk, Brett. It builds up your bones.
He drank half his milk and grew an old man's mustache. He set the glass down.
Maybe he did. He could have got Gary to go with him, maybe. He likes Gary a lot.
Yes, maybe he did get Gary to go with him, Charity said. She spoke as if this idea had never occurred to her, but in fact she had called Gary's house this morning while Brett had been out in the backyard playing with Jim Jr. There had been no answer. She hadn't a doubt in the world that they were together, wherever they were.
You haven't eaten much of that Danish.
He picked it up, took a token bite, and put it down again.
Mom, I think Cujo was sick. He looked sick when I saw him yesterday morning. Honest to God.
Brett,
he did, Mom. You didn't see him. He looked, well, gross.
If you knew Cujo was all right, would it set your mind at rest?
Brett nodded.
Then we'll call Alva Thornton down on the maple sugar tonight, she said. Have him go up and check, okay? My guess is your father already called him and asked him to feed Cujo while he's gone.
Do you really think so?
Yes, I do.
Alva or someone like Alva. Not really Joe's friends, because, to the best of her knowledge, Gary was the only real friend Joe had. But men who would do a favor for a favor in return at some future time.
Brett's expression cleared magically. Once again, the grown-up had produced the right answer, like a rabbit from a hat.
Instead of cheering her, it turned her momentarily glum. What was she going to tell him if she called Alva, and he said he hadn't seen Joe since mud season? Well, she would cross that bridge if she came to it. But she continued to believe that Joe wouldn't have just left Cujo to shift for himself. It wasn't like him.
Want to go find your aunt now?
Sure. Just let me finish this.
She watched, half amused and half appalled, as he gobbled the rest of the Danish in three great bites and chased it with the rest of the milk. Then he pushed his chair back. Charity paid the check and they went out to the down escalator.
Geez, this sure is a big store, Brett said wonderingly. It's a big city, isn't it, Mom?
New York makes this look like Castle Rock, she said.
And don't say geez, Brett. It's the same as swearing.
Okay.
He held the moving railing, looking around. To the right of them was a maze of twittering, chirruping parakeets. To the left was the housewares department, with chrome glittering everywhere, and a dishwasher that had a front made entirely of glass so you could check out its sudsing action. He looked up at his mother as they got off the escalator.
You two grew up together, huh?
Hope to tell you, Charity said, smiling.
She's real nice, Brett said.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I was always partial to her myself.
How did she get so rich?
Charity stopped.
Is that what you think Holly and Jim are? Rich?
That house they live in didn't come cheap, he said.
And again she could see his father peeking around the corners of his unformed face, Joe Camber with his shapeless green hat tipped far back on his head, his eyes, too wise, shifted off to one side.
And that jukebox, that was dear, too. She's got a whole wallet of those credit cards, and all we've got is the Texaco.
She rounded on him.
You think it's smart to go peeking into people's wallets when they've just bought you a nice lunch?
His face looked hurt and surprised. Then it closed up and became smooth. That was a Joe Camber trick, too.
I just noticed. Would have been had not to, the way she was showing them off.
She was not showing them off, Charity said, shocked.
She stopped again. They had reached the edge of the drapery department.
Yeah, she was, Brett said. If they'd been an accordion, she would have been playing Lady of Spain.
She was suddenly furious with him, partly because she suspected he might be right.
She wanted you to see all of them, Brett said. That's what I think.
I'm not particularly interested in what you think on the subject, Brett Camber.
Her face felt hot. Her hands itched to strike him. A few moments ago in the cafeteria she had been loving him. Just as important, she had felt like his friend. Where had those good feelings gone?
I just wondered how she got so much dough.
That's sort of a crude word to use for it, don't you think?
He shrugged, openly antagonistic now, provoking her purposely, she suspected. It went back to his perception of what had happened at lunch, but it went further back than that. He was contrasting his own way of life and his father's way of life with another one. Had she thought he would automatically embrace the way that her sister and her husband lived just because Charity wanted him to embrace it, a lifestyle that she herself had been denied, either by bad luck, her own stupidity, or both? Had he no right to criticize or analyze? Yes, she acknowledged that he did, but she hadn't expected that his observation would be so unsettling, if intuitively. Sophisticated, so accurate, or so depressingly negative.
I suppose it was Jim who made the money, she said.
You know what he does?
Yeah, he's a pencil pusher.
But this time she refused to be drawn.
If you want to see it that way. Holly married him when he was in college at the University of Maine in Portland, studying pre-law. While he was in law school in Denver,
She worked a lot of crummy jobs to see that he got through. It's often done that way. Wives work so their husbands can go to school and learn some special skill. She was searching for Holly with her eyes, and finally thought she saw the top of her younger sister's head several aisles to the left. Anyway, when Jim finally got out of school, he and Holly came east, and he went to work in Bridgeport with a big firm of lawyers. He didn't make much money then. They lived in a third-floor apartment with no air conditioning in the summer and not much heat in the winter. But he's worked his way up, and now he's what's called a junior partner. And I suppose he does make a lot of money by our standards. Maybe she shows her credit cards around because sometimes she still feels poor inside, Brett said. She was struck by the almost eerie perceptiveness of that as well. She ruffled his hair gently, no longer angry at him. "You did say you liked her."
"Yeah, I do."
"There she is, right over there."
"I see her."
They went over and joined Holly, who already had an armload of curtains and was now prospecting for tablecloths. The sun had finally gone down behind the house. Little by little, the oven that was inside the Trentons' pinto began to cool off. A more or less steady breeze sprang up, and Tad turned his face into it gratefully. He felt better, at least for the time being, than he had all day. In fact, all the rest of the day before now seemed like a terribly bad dream, one he could only partly remember. At times he had gone away, had simply left the car and gone away. He could remember that. He had gone on a horse. He and the horse had ridden down a long field, and there were rabbits playing there, just like in that cartoon his mommy and daddy had taken him to see at the Magic Lantern Theater in Bridgeton. There was a pond at the end of the field, and ducks in the pond. The ducks were friendly. Tad played with them. It was better there than with Mommy, because the monster was where Mommy was, the monster that had gotten out of his closet. The monster was not in the place where the ducks were. Tad liked it there, although he knew in a vague way that if he stayed in that place too long, he might forget how to get back to the car. Then the sun had gone behind the house. There were cool shadows, almost thick enough to have a texture, like velvet. The monster had stopped trying to get them. The mailman hadn't come, but at least now he was able to rest comfortably. The worst thing was being so thirsty. Never in his life had he wanted a drink so much. That was what made the place where the ducks were so nice. It was a wet, green place.
"What did you say, honey?"
Mommy's face was bending down over him.
"Thirsty," he said in a frog's croak. "I'm so thirsty, Mommy."
He remembered that he used to say "firsty" instead of "thirsty," but some of the kids at day camp had laughed at him and called him a baby, the same way they laughed at Randy Hoffnager for saying "breakfast" when he meant breakfast. So he began to say it right, scolding himself fiercely inside whenever he forgot.
"Yes, I know. Mommy's thirsty, too." "I bet there's water in the house."
"Honey, we can't go into the house. Not just yet. The bad dog's in front of the car."
"Where?"
Tad got up on his knees and was surprised at the lightness that ran lazily through his head like a slow-breaking wave. He put a hand on the dashboard to support himself, and the hand seemed on the end of an arm that was a mile long.
"I don't see him."
Even his voice was distant, echoey.
"Sit back down, Tad. You're..."
She was still talking, and he could feel her sitting him back into the seat, but it was all distant. The words were coming to him over a long, gray distance. It was foggy between him and her, as it had been foggy this morning, or yesterday morning, or on whatever morning it had been when his